This is a reading of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. This is Chapter 51. I was 36 years old at the end of my time in Weimar. About a year earlier, a profound transformation began in my soul. When I left Weimar, that transformation became a decisive experience. It had nothing to do with the change in my outer situation, though that was enormous. Knowledge and experience of the spiritual world had always been self-evident to me, whereas to comprehend the sensory world through physical perception caused me tremendous difficulty. It was as if my inner soul experience did not go far enough into the sensory organs to unite fully with what they perceived. This changed entirely with the beginning of my 36th year. My ability to observe physical matter, processes, and beings became more accurate and insistent. This was the situation in relation to both science and ordinary life. I had always found it easy to comprehend the broader scientific relationships that have to be understood in a purely spiritual way. It had taken tremendous effort, however, to observe material objects accurately, and especially to memorize them. This changed completely. A new attentiveness for sensory perceptible phenomena awakened within me. Details became important. I had the feeling that the sensory world could show something that only it can reveal. I considered it an ideal to become familiar with the physical world purely through what it had to say, without carrying into it any of one's own thoughts or other aspect of soul. I became aware that I was experiencing an inner transformation of soul that usually occurs at a much earlier age, and I realized that this has very definite consequences for the soul's life. I found that people come to a pure understanding of neither the spiritual world nor the physical, because they pass from the soul's involvement in the spirit world to experiencing the physical world at an early age. After that, what phenomena have to say to the senses is instinctively mixed together with what the soul experiences through the spirit, and with what is needed to form mental representation of that phenomena. This increased precision and more thorough penetration of sensory observation opened a door for me to an entirely new world. When the sensory realm is approached objectively, free of all subjectivity, it reveals something about which spiritual insight has nothing to say. This also shed light on the spiritual realm. When the true nature of the physical reveals itself purely through sensory observation, it is also possible for cognition to determine the distinct nature of the spiritual, free of any physical impressions. This experience was all the more incisive for my inner life, because its effect shows itself in human life as well. My skills of observation assumed the task of observing, with complete objectivity and purity, what a person manifests in life. I scrupulously refrained from criticizing the actions of others, or allowing affinity or aversion to influence my relationships with them. My whole endeavor was to, quote, allow human beings, just as they are, to make impressions on me, unquote. I soon discovered that this way of observing the world, in fact, leads into the spiritual world. By observing the physical world this way, one completely leaves oneself. This, in turn, enables one to return to the spiritual world with enhanced powers of spiritual observation. Consequently, at that time, the full contrast between the spiritual and physical worlds appeared to my soul. I did not feel, however, that this difference needed to be reconciled by philosophical argument, as a monism, for example. Instead, I felt that one's ability to stand fully in this contrast with the soul means that one understands life. The experience of such contrasts, when balanced out, dies and becomes lifeless. Where there is life, the disharmony of contrast is active. Life itself implies continuously overcoming and recreating opposites. Out of all this, I felt pressing in on me an extremely intense devotion to experiencing life's mysteries, and not merely grasping them in theories. In order to find a true relationship to the world through meditation, I repeatedly placed before my soul this thought: the world is full of mysteries. I can approach them with the power of cognition, but that leads one to thought content as a solution to a mystery. But, so I told myself, mysteries are not solved by thoughts. Thoughts bring the soul to the path of solution, but do not contain the solution. A mystery arises within the real world as a phenomenon. The solution arises equally in that reality. Something appears as being or process and solves the problem. I also thought, the whole world, except for the human being, is a mystery, the actual world mystery, and human beings themselves are the solution. Consequently, I could think, the human being at any moment can speak of that universal mystery, but they can never say more of the answer than they have learned about themselves as human beings. Thus cognition also becomes a process in reality. Questions reveal themselves in the world. Answers reveal themselves as realities. Knowledge is human participation in what is revealed by the beings and processes of the spiritual and physical worlds. I had already implied this, and at times clearly stated it, in my writings before the time described. It became an extremely intense soul experience every time I looked for insight through meditation into the ground of the world. Most important, this soul experience, with all its intensity at the time, arose from an objective devotion to pure, clear sensory observation. I was given a new world through that observation. All that I had cognized inwardly up to that point, I now had to find in the soul's corresponding experience in order to create a balance with the new. Whenever the substantiality of the sensory world is merely perceived, not thought, an enigma arises in reality. And the answer to that mystery is in the human being. I was deeply enthusiastic about what I later called knowledge conforming to reality. In particular, it was clear to me that such knowledge, truly conforming to reality, does not leave the human being out of the world processes. For me, knowledge does not belong only to the human being, but to the existence and arising of the world as a whole. The root and the trunk of a tree are not complete unless they lead all the way to blossom. Likewise, the world's existence and arising do not truly exist unless they continue to live and become the essence of knowledge. This insight caused me to repeat, whenever appropriate, as human beings, we are not the beings who create the essence of knowledge for ourselves. Rather, our soul provides the stage on which the world itself begins in part to experience its own becoming and existence. Without knowledge, the world would remain incomplete. In such a cognitive participating in the reality of the world, I increasingly found it possible to defend the nature of human knowledge against the view that human beings merely produce a kind of copy of the world in the mind through cognition. In my view of cognition, the human being is a co-creator, not a copier of the world. We do not merely produce something that could have been omitted from the world without leaving it incomplete. This also shed a clearer light on mysticism for me. It retrieved human experience of the universal process from indefinite mystical feelings and placed it in the light where the ideas reveal themselves. The root and trunk of a tree are initially without blossoms, and likewise the sensory world, when merely perceived in its particulars, is without ideas to begin with. And the blossom is not the fading of the plant's life, but a transformation of this existence. Similarly, the human idea world is, in relation to the sensory world, is a metamorphosis of physical existence, not an obscure mystical effect produced vaguely in the human soul world. All that lives as knowledge in the human being, in the human soul, must shine just as clear and bright as do physical phenomena in the light of the sun. For me, this insight was a crystal clear soul experience, but it was extraordinarily difficult to express it. Toward the end of my Weimar period, I wrote, titled Goethe's Worldview, and the introduction to the last volume of the Goethe edition that I edited for Kirchner's, titled German National Literature. I recall in particular what I wrote to introduce Goethe's, titled Aphorisms in Prose, in comparison to how I formulated, titled Goethe's Worldview. If these two works, which I wrote more or less simultaneously, are read superficially, one can detect one or another contradiction between them. But if one looks for what is living below the surface, one will notice that what is revealed on the surface, formulations of the direct experience of the deeper areas of life, soul, and spirit, will not appear as a contradiction, but a struggle for a means of expression. It is a struggle to formulate concepts as a worldview, concepts just as I have described here as the experience of knowledge, the human relationship to the world, and the arising and solving of the mysteries of true reality. About 3.5 years later, when I wrote, titled Conceptions of the World and of Life in the 19th Century, much of this had developed further within me. My experience of the process of knowing, as described here, bore fruit when I had to sketch various philosophies throughout history. In my view, those who reject writings in which the soul struggles cognitively, that is, because the cosmic struggle unfolds on the stage of the human soul, cannot with consciousness successfully penetrate true reality. For a long time this had lived through my world of concepts, but now it was confirmed by spiritual perception. The end of chapter 51. Chapter 52. Very important inner experiences were associated with the transformation in my soul life. I learned through inner experience the nature of meditation and its significance for understanding the spiritual realm. I had led a meditative life before then, but that impulse was the result of an ideal knowledge of its value for a philosophy that acknowledges the spirit. But now something arose within me that demanded meditation as an absolute necessity for my soul life. The soul life had reached a stage where meditation became a necessity, just as an organism at a certain stage of evolution needs to breathe through lungs. The relationship between ordinary conceptual knowledge, gained through sensory perception, and perception of the spiritual sphere was no longer merely an experience in the realm of ideas. It became an experience in which the whole human being participated. My title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom, was born from the experience of ideas that encompassed spiritual reality. The experience involving the whole human being contains the spiritual world in a much more substantial way than the idea experience. Yet, when ideas are experienced directly, it represents a higher stage than the ordinary conceptual understanding of the sensory realm. Through directly experienced ideas, one comprehends not the sense world, but the spiritual world adjoining the sense world. As this was seeking expression and experience in my soul, three kinds of knowledge stood before my inner being. The first is conceptual knowledge, gained through sensory observation. Such knowledge is assimilated and then retained according to the power of memory. Repetition of this is significant only to the degree that it helps one retain it in memory. The second kind of knowledge does not acquire concepts through sensory observation. They are experienced inwardly and free of the senses. The very nature of this experience assures that such concepts are based on spiritual reality. One experiences the fact that concepts contain an assurance of spiritual reality with the same certainty, through the nature of the experience itself, that one has in recognizing the difference between physical reality and illusion when acquiring knowledge of the sensory world. Unlike knowledge of the sensory world, it is not enough merely to assimilate this ideal spiritual knowledge so that it is possessed as a memory of it. Assimilation must be an ongoing process. It is not enough for an organism to breathe for a while and then use that assimilated breath to continue its life processes. Similarly, it is not enough to assimilate ideal spiritual knowledge only once, as one does sensory knowledge. It is necessary for the soul to continually reciprocate with the world it enters through such knowledge. This occurs through meditation, which, as indicated above, is pursued out of the ideal insight of its value. I had sought this reciprocal relationship long before the transformation in my soul in my 35th year. Then it happened that meditation became an absolute necessity for the life of the soul. Along with this, the third kind of knowledge appeared before my inner being. It led not only more deeply into the spiritual world, but allowed a living, intimate union with that world. Because of inner necessity, I repeatedly had to place a very particular kind of mental picture at the center of my consciousness. If I vigorously go into mental pictures derived from the sense world, I am, in terms of direct experience, in a position to speak of the concrete existence of what is experienced only so long as I am observing the object or event. The senses guarantee the truth of the observed as long as I observe. But this is not true when, through purely ideal spiritual knowledge, I unite with the being or events of the spiritual world. In this knowledge, one has, in a single perception, direct experience of its continuous existence beyond the duration of the perception itself. If, for example, one experiences the human I, capital, as the very center of one's own being, then one also knows, in direct perceptual experience, that this I existed before life in the physical body, and that it will continue after the end of that life. What one experiences of the I reveals itself directly, just as a rose reveals its redness to direct perception. In such meditation, practiced out of inner necessity for spiritual life, one becomes increasingly aware of an inner human spirit that can live, perceive, and move within the spirit realm, entirely detached from the physical organism. The influence of meditation allowed this independent spiritual human to enter the realm of my experience, which greatly deepened my experience of the spirit. It can easily be proved through ordinary self-observation that knowledge of the physical world is attained through the bodily organism, yet even ideal spiritual knowledge still depends on the organism. In this sense, self-observation demonstrates that when we observe through the senses, each individual act of cognition is bound to the organism. In ideal spiritual knowledge, every individual act of cognition is completely independent of the physical organism, but the fact that we can develop this kind of knowledge at all depends on life in general within the organism. Nevertheless, the third kind of knowledge arises only through the spiritual human being, and only when it can free itself of the physical organism as though the physical were completely absent. I became aware of all this through the meditation described. By directly experiencing the facts, I was able to disprove completely the notion that in such meditation one is the subject of a kind of auto-suggestion that leads to spiritual experience. When I first attained ideal spiritual knowledge, I became convinced of the truth of the spiritual experience, and I really mean the very first instant. I am not referring only to what remained alive in the meditation, I mean what first began to live. In this I had already applied the method whereby, by means of thoughtful awareness, one generally establishes the absolute exact truth of the matter before there could be any question of autosuggestion. What I attained through meditating, therefore, had to be a matter of the experience whose reality I was able to test fully even before the actual experience. All this was associated with my soul transformation and came to light in relation to the result of self-observation that was now possible. And, like what has been described, it came to have momentous significance for me. I could feel a certain aspect of the conceptual element of my inner life receding, replaced by the element of will. This could happen only when volition abstained from all subjective impulsiveness in regard to developing knowledge. The will increased in direct proportion to the decrease in conceptual element. The will also took over spiritual cognition, which had previously been accomplished almost exclusively by the conceptual element. I had realized that distinguishing the soul life as thinking, feeling, and willing has limited significance. In reality, thinking also contains feeling and will. It is simply that thinking predominates over the other two. Thinking and willing also live in feeling, and likewise feeling and thinking in the will. Now I consciously experienced how the will absorbed more thinking, and thinking absorbed more of the will. On the one hand, meditation leads to knowledge of spirit. On the other, the results of such self-observation lead to an inner strengthening of the human spirit, independent of the organism, and establishes its being in the spirit world, just as the physical human being is established in the physical world. One has a growing awareness that the connection between the human spirit and the spiritual world becomes infinitely stronger once the physical organism no longer hinders that connection. But at death, the connection between the physical organism and the physical world is destroyed when the human spirit ceases to sustain that connection. Such an experiential cognition is incompatible with all theories of knowledge that limit human cognition to a certain sphere. Those that place the primordial ground, or thing in itself, into a beyond that is unavailable to human knowledge. The unattainable was unavailable to me only to begin with, and it remains unattainable only so long as we have not inwardly developed what by its very nature corresponds to the unknown and enables us to unite with it in conscious experience. Those who want to see the true human relationship to the world in the right light must acknowledge the human ability to grow into every kind of existence. Those who cannot acknowledge this will view knowledge not as a part of the world, but merely as an insignificant copy of some part of the world. And with the cognition that merely forms copies, we cannot grasp an inner being who, as a fully conscious individuality, provides us with inner experience of our firm stance in the cosmos as a whole. It was important to me to speak of knowledge so that the spirit was not merely acknowledged but recognized as perceivable by human beings. To me it seemed more important to establish that the primordial ground of existence lies within the totality of human experience than to acknowledge theoretically some unknown spirit in some unknown beyond. Consequently, I had to reject the way of thinking that explains sensations, color, warmth, sound, and so on, merely as an unknown outer world that is evoked in the human being through sensory perception, whereas the outer world itself can be conceived only hypothetically. To my experiential cognition, the basic theories of physics and physiology appeared especially harmful. This inner experience became increasingly vivid and intense during that period of my life. Everything described in physics and physiology as, quote, that which lies behind subjective sensations, unquote, caused me inner, if I may say it in this way, cognitive discomfort. On the other hand, despite the incomplete form of their ideas, there was a trend of thinking that could become healthy when carried further, which I recognized in Lyell, Darwin, and Haeckel. For example, as it was presented, Lyell's principle seemed productive to me, that we can explain the phenomena of Earth's evolution, not available to sensory observation, because they are past, by using ideas derived from observing the current evolutionary phenomena. It also seemed to me that a good basis for furthering knowledge would be to try to understand the human physical structure by deriving the human form from animal forms, as Haeckel does in such a comprehensive way in his title Evolution of the Human Being. I thought that human beings bar themselves from the spirit world by limiting themselves to the quote-unquote thing in itself as it is supposed to exist. On the other hand, they view the sensory world in a way that allows them to see that things explain one another. For example, the present stage of Earth geologically explains the past, and animal forms explain those of the human being. Then they also become prepared to broaden this type of explanation of phenomena to include spirit. Here, too, I could say that for a long time this had been a living experience in my conceptual world, but now it was confirmed by spiritual perception. The end of chapter 52. Chapter 53. I must conclude this second chapter of my life with the transformation I have described in my soul life. My destiny began a completely new direction. In Vienna and Weimar, the work that came to me through external circumstances harmonized completely with my inner efforts. All of my writings were based on the foundation of my worldview according to spirit, even when inner necessity required that I consider less of that spiritual sphere itself. The aims of my teaching in Vienna arose from the insights of my own soul. Everything I did in relation to the Goethe work in Weimar was determined entirely by what I considered the real task of such an undertaking. I encountered no particular difficulty in bringing the external tasks into harmony with my inner aims. This is exactly what made it possible for me to observe and present the idea of freedom in a way that seemed clear to me. I do not think that the significance I placed on my perspective of freedom made me one-sided. Freedom, after all, is an objective reality that cannot be altered by the personal experience of one who conscientiously strives for knowledge. At most, personal experience affects the degree of possible insight. My view of freedom was directly connected with the generally misunderstood concept of ethical individualism in my worldview. This, too, is one of the concepts that was enhanced significantly as inner experience at the beginning of the third chapter of my life. Previously, it had been a living element in my conceptual world. Now it became a powerful inner experience that took hold of the human being. It became necessary that I continue to perfect the way I formulated my own views of the areas investigated by physics and physiology, and also biology, which, though incomplete, I realized could become a bridge to a spiritual worldview. I had to discover whether an impulse that stimulates the human to action can reveal itself in the external world. I found that the spiritual divine forces that ensoul the human will cannot enter the inner human from outside. When physics, physiology, and biology are approached in the right way, it seemed to me that they do in fact lead to this conclusion. Nature has provided no way for a will impulse to enter the human being from outside. It follows that no spiritual, divine, moral impulses can penetrate from outside to the center of the soul, where human impulses of will arise. External, natural forces can draw only on what is natural in the human being. In reality, then, this is not an expression of free will, but merely an extension of outer natural activity, expressed in turn through the human being. Consequently, human beings do not fully possess their own being, but remain as beings who act without freedom, stuck in all that corresponds to nature. Again and again I realized that the truly important question is not whether human will is free, but a very different question. What is the soul's path from unfree, natural will to freedom, that is, to a truly moral will? This question can be answered only by looking at the way divine spirit lives within each individual human soul. Morality arises from the individual human soul. Consequently, the moral impulse must be ignited in that holy individual being of the human soul. Moral laws, in the form of commandments and arising from our external situation, do not become moral impulses when we orient our will according to them, even those that came originally from the spiritual world. Moral impulses arise only when an individual experiences thinking as a living spiritual reality within. Freedom lives in human thinking. The will is not itself free, but thought gives that power to the will. In title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, A Philosophy of Freedom, I emphatically stressed freedom of thought in relation to the moral nature of the will. This idea also became strengthened through meditation in particular. The moral world order revealed itself with increasing clarity as the earthly manifestation of the imprint of an order of activity in higher spiritual regions. It became self-evident that it comes within our conceptual grasp once we are able to acknowledge the reality of spirit. It was right at this point in my life that all of these insights came together as the comprehensive truth I had recognized earlier, that world phenomena are not really clarified when thinking is used to explain, but rather when using thinking, one sees the relationships among phenomena in such a way that they explain one another. In those relationships, one phenomenon is seen as a mystery, another as the solution, and human beings themselves become the word for the outer world they perceive. Thus the truth of the imagination became direct inner experience, logos, wisdom. The word ruled the world and all its processes. I felt that with such imaginations, I could clearly understand the nature of materialism. I did not consider materialistic thinking to be destructive because it turns all its attention toward the material aspect of phenomena, but because of the way it thinks of matter. When materialists investigate a substance, they do not notice that in reality they are face to face with spirit manifested as matter. They fail to realize that spirit transforms itself into substance in order to reach a mode of activity that is possible only in that form. Spirit must first assume the form of a material brain in order to live there in a world of mental images that gives the free activity of self-awareness to human beings in earthly life. It is true that in the brain, spirit arises from matter, but only after the material brain arises from spirit. I had to reject the way thinking was applied by physics and physiology, simply because physical matter, when not experienced but merely intellectualized, has been presented as the external stimulus of human experience of spirit. Consequently, matter is thought of in such a way that it is impossible to trace it to where it becomes spirit. Such matter, considered real by this way of thinking, simply does not exist anywhere. The basic mistake in the research of physical phenomena by materialistic thinkers involves their impossible concept of matter, and this blocks the way leading to spiritual presence. When matter arouses only one's experiences of nature and the soul, it becomes a world of illusion. The strength of my experience of these thoughts led me to elaborate them 4 years later in The World as Illusion, entitled Conceptions of the World and of Life in the 19th Century, later expanded and retitled The Riddles of Philosophy. In the biological way of thinking, it is not possible for human thinking to be completely driven in this way from the realm of direct experience to one that offers only illusion. In biology, one cannot maintain that human beings are surrounded by a world they do not experience, one that merely makes an impression on the senses and may not resemble in the least its phenomenal cause. One may ignore the substantial nature of thinking and believe that it expresses something to say that the subjective perception of light corresponds to some objective form of movement in the ether. That was the viewpoint at the time. But only a total fanatic would try to explain in this way what is perceived in the realm of life. It was clear to me that such thinking can never arise beyond ideas of nature to become ideas of the moral order of the world. Ideas formulated in this way imagine that morality falls into the human physical realm from somewhere inaccessible to the power of cognition. I do not consider it particularly significant that such questions occupied my soul as I entered the third period of my life. They had occupied me for a long time. But it was important to me that by immersing myself in them at that point, my whole realm of knowledge, without changing substantially, became much more vivid and alive than before. The human soul lives in Logos. But how does the external world live in Logos? This is the essential question in my theory of knowledge, titled Theory of Knowledge Implicit in Goethe's World Conception, written in the mid-1880s. The same was true of title Truth and Knowledge, and title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path. This soul orientation guided all my thinking in attempting to penetrate the depths of the human soul, from which Goethe tried to bring light to the phenomenal world. At this time in my life, I was especially concerned about the fact that the ideas I had vigorously rejected had such an intense hold on current thinking. People's lives were so completely oriented in that direction that they were unable to see the possibilities inherent in anything that pointed in the opposite direction. I felt so deeply this contrast between what I perceived clearly as truth and the conventional views of my time that it gave the essential coloring to my life during those years of the turn of the century. I encountered that contrast in every aspect of culture. I certainly did not reject everything produced by modern culture. I did, however, feel deep pain, especially in relation to the many excellent things that I could value, because I thought I saw destructive powers everywhere opposing such seeds of cultural development. So, everywhere, I was confronted by the problem of how to express in contemporary terms the truth as directly perceived inwardly. Faced with this problem, one feels as though one has to scale an almost unclimbable mountain. One makes attempts from various starting points, only to be frustrated again and again, realizing that all efforts are in vain. Once during the 1890s, I spoke in Frankfurt am Main on Goethe's view of nature. By way of introduction, I said that I wanted to talk only about Goethe's view of organic nature, because it is impossible in conventional physics to build a bridge to his ideas on light and color. To me, however, that very impossibility was a significant symptom of the spiritual direction of the age. Sometime later, I had a conversation with a physicist who was important in his field, one who had worked a great deal with Goethe's view of nature. That conversation culminated when he said, quote, "Because of the nature of Goethe's ideas on color, physics can do nothing with them," unquote. There was nothing to be said. I became silent. From all directions I seemed to hear, "Today's conventional thinking is unable to do anything with what is now most clearly true to you." The end of chapter 53 and the end of this reading, section of the reading.